You. And I just want to ask, did you ever get to see The Color Purple?
No. No.
Bishop William Barber, President and Senior Lecturer at Repairers of the Breach, Founding Director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. In our post show at democracynow.org, we're going to ask you about your piece, Evangelical Appeal to Moral Case for Ceasefire in Gaza. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a deadly trend involving traffic wrecks and pedestrians, both in Oregon and across the country. Efforts to bolster mental health are taking on a new urgency this year. And a shooting in Iowa with several young victims at a school, another mass shooting on a growing list. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 4th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. A new report published in the New York Times points out that the pedestrian deaths from traffic accidents have increased in the U.S. starting in the year 2009 until now. Now, this bucks the trend of fewer traffic pedestrian deaths in every other major industrialized nation in the world. Portland just suffered a record 71 traffic fatalities in 2023. Portland Police Chief Bob Day mentioned that and other points of both pain and progress as he reflected on the past year.
Sadly, we are closed out the year with a record number of traffic deaths. Yet we remain committed to raising awareness and conducting enforcement in our high crash corridors. We are pleased to have the Traffic Division back. We also appreciate our partnerships with the Portland Bureau of Transportation and different neighborhood associations. That said, we all own our part in keeping our roadways safe. Most of these crashes are preventable. Moving forward, we will focus on continuing to use data and technology to help us work more efficiently and effectively. We started our drone pilot project. Drones can assist with measurements and assessments required for fatal traffic crashes. What takes a human being hours, the drone can accomplish in minutes. It also has been used by the Metro Explosive Disposal Unit to gather information from a safe distance about possible explosive devices and other incidents involving danger to the community. We launched a dashboard so the public can see where and how often we are using the drones. Sticking with technology, we are anxious to implement the body-worn camera program in 2024. Our pilot this year helped outline small adjustments we need to make regarding policy and training. We'll be working with the vendor on acquiring the equipment and training the rest of our personnel. Officers and the community are both eager for the cameras, and we want this implemented as soon as possible. Accountability and transparency remain my priority. We continue to work with the Department of Justice on the settlement agreement with the city, and I have personally pledged my commitment to being more communicative about our work. We need your involvement. Continue to ask questions and participate in your neighborhoods.
That was Portland Police Chief Bob Day. You probably have heard about a mass shooting at an Iowa school today. Police say that a 17-year-old killed a sixth grader and wounded five others in the shooting at Perry High School in the town of Perry. Students barricaded themselves in offices, ducked in classrooms, or ran for exits before the suspected shooter was eventually found dead. This comes on the heels of several years of mass shootings in the U.S. I talked to historian and author Dr. Chris Nichols about the trend of mass shootings in 2023.
We were talking about gun violence, and they're starting to recommend now that kids be taught how to stop bleeding in schools. And we're starting to have drills for what to do if there's a mass shooter coming in workplaces. And it's, I guess, just continuing. the trend line doesn't seem to be abating there.
No, it absolutely isn't. One of the most striking things when I think at the intersection of American politics and the international system, which is where my mind often goes in trying to think, especially to think about the significance of issues in the U.S., we often get a little bit parochial as Americans and in the media, is to think about, well, how does this fit with overall trends and patterns? And there's just no doubt that the U.S. is the world leader in mass shootings and mass violence. And this marks a year where it looks likely that there will be a minimum of twice as many or something on the order of twice as many mass shootings as days in the year. So as in 365 days, something like times two, give or take a bit. And it's amazing how inured we have been. If people can think back to if they were around and cognizant when Columbine happened, or even most recently, one of the sort of amplifying effects of what all has happened was the Sandy Hook massacre of all those children. And most recently we saw, we don't even pick out on our list, yours and my list of tragedies and triumphs of the year, any single mass shooting because they now all blur together. You look at the in the world, in a given year, the U.S. has all these and in the next highest country might have five.
Wasn't there one in Europe, in Prague, I want to say?
Just recently, in fact. Like, there have been in a few different years, there have been a number, but there's so few and so rare. And there's lots of meaningful ways that we could think about what kinds of gun reforms other countries have put forward and how they worked. And this is well studied. And this has actually come up a lot in Oregon in terms of Oregon laws attempting to put more strictures on gun ownership, gun use, et cetera. Again, if you think about mass shootings globally and in the U.S. context, another thing that's important to raise here, and it's not just the tragedies of these mass shootings, but also the fact that the U.S. is a world leader in gun-related deaths and gun-related suicides. So the fact that we have all these weapons percolating around in society isn't just about violent crime or these really inflammatory events that make us all scared and have us do these trainings. I never thought as a professor I would need to know how to lock doors and lock down for shooting incident events. But across American society, the bigger and most significant element at work is just how many suicides are happening and deaths overall. Mass shootings are a small fraction of the overall gun deaths in the U.S. And if you really wanted to meaningfully change that, then that does look like gun laws as well, because we know very well that the countries that don't have an enormous amount of circulating firearms have fewer successful suicides.
A newly discovered antibiotic might help fight drug-resistant infections. KBOO's Ezra has more in the story.
Broad-spectrum antibiotics can be used against multiple types of infections, but in recent years, these bacteria have developed resistance to the antibiotics. People who get these infections face serious disease and death, particularly in hospitals and nursing homes. More than 35,000 people die each year from drug-resistant infections, such as pneumonia or sepsis, according to the CDC. Scientists have created a new antibiotic dubbed Zoshirabalpin, which targets one specific infection called carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter baumannii, or CRAB. It's difficult to effectively treat because it's gram-negative, meaning it's protected by two layers of membrane. It keeps out antibiotics much more effectively than gram-positive bacteria, which are only protected with one layer of membrane. Enter Zoshirabalpin, a new research molecule. It works by stopping protective fatty acids from reaching the cell's outer membrane, which increases toxicity until the cell dies. It's been deemed effective in lab studies on mice, but it may be years before it's approved for clinical use. For KBOO News, I'm Ezra.
As Oregon lawmakers get ready for their upcoming session in February, one of the topics they plan to tackle is mental health. Governor Tina Kotek talked about a new special service for Oregon farmers, ranchers, loggers, and fishermen as she reflected on the past year.
Many of the most heartfelt conversations on our visits were about mental health and addiction. Way too many Oregonians have personal experience, whether themselves or their family members or someone they know that they grew up with that's been dealing with a mental health or addiction issue. And I spent a lot of time hearing from communities about access to care being important, making sure you have the workforce you need, whether you're an enterprise in Malawi County or Grants Pass in Josephine County. Communities need to make sure that they can provide the care that people need. One of the highlights of my year has been the signing of the Agri-Stress Hotline Bill in Prairie City in Grant County. That's a hotline that is specifically set up for farmers and ranchers and fishermen, people who are in the natural resource world who are dealing with a lot of stress. That's just one thing we can do right now to help Oregonians. But there are a lot of complex issues out there, and my job is to make sure communities have what they need to make sure people have the health care they need.
And that was Oregon Governor Tina Kotek. Just last week, December 28th, an Oregon Court of Appeals blocked the Multnomah County flavored tobacco ban. This ban would prohibit the sale of flavored nicotine products within Multnomah County and would apply to all licensed tobacco retailers within the county. Unless further legal challenges block it later in 2024, retailers can expect to be penalized unless they remove flavored tobacco and nicotine products from their shelves. The county planned to conduct inspections to ensure the ban's qualifications are being met if it's implemented and issue penalties to shops not in compliance. Earlier last year, a judge dismissed a case against the county, ruling in favor of the ban. It passed in December of 2022. The ban is now on hold, with local vape and tobacco shops able to keep flavored nicotine products on their shelves for a while longer. With Nevada expected to be a very important race in the upcoming presidential election, the vice president showed up to cheer on union members and celebrate contract negotiations, which led to increases in wages and workplace safety improvements. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Vice President Kamala Harris kicked off 2024 with a stop in Las Vegas on Wednesday to join culinary union members in celebrating new contracts negotiated with some of the largest hotel operators in Southern Nevada. After settling union contracts for more than 40,000 hospitality workers, the culinary union says the win will bring historic wage increases and workplace safety improvements. Harris says workers are the backbone of the nation.
It is union members and the working people who are members of organized labor who have always fought and continue to fight for the rights, for the dignity of working people and the dignity of work itself.
The vice president said the culinary union's achievements signal to other unions around the country what can be achieved and the power they have. Her visit to the Silver State comes as the Biden-Harris administration seeks a second term in D.C., with Nevada being a key battleground state that Biden won back in 2020. Acting Labor Secretary Julie Sue says union organizers in Nevada made history last year with their contract negotiations at the bargaining table. She says what members have done is help reset and lift up the market rate.
And I've heard corporations say that the wage increase you want is too far above the market rate. My response to that is, why, instead of telling workers that their demands are too high, why don't we start to question why the market rate is so low?
Sue adds that unions help close race and gender pay gaps. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees says Latina union workers can earn up to 40% more than their non-union counterparts. For Black women, belonging to a union means they earn 24% more than their non-union colleagues. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The Latinx community accounts for almost half of the agriculture and construction workforce in America, and studies show more than half of them live in states with the highest levels of climate change threats, such as air pollution, extreme heat, and flooding. Roz Brown has more on the story.
As climate change makes extreme weather events more common globally, Latinos often face the most significant impacts to their health, safety, food security, and livelihoods. A new report from the Hispanic Access Foundation details those impacts and how climate change erodes cultural legacy when neighborhoods undergo gentrification, displacing traditional communities. Conservation Program Manager Vanessa Munoz says Latinos in every state are experiencing challenges to their mental health and identity due to climate change.
Some places might suffer severe temperatures, and others might be more exposed to flooding or to a lot of wildfires, which is often where a lot of the Latino communities reside.
In New Mexico, she says drought and higher temperatures threaten Latinos, while in other states they're displaced by rising sea levels. 71% of Latino adults said climate change already impacts their local community. To promote what she calls a just transition towards a climate-friendly economy for all people, Munoz says the report includes a toolkit and policy recommendations to help communities better preserve Latino heritage.
One of the ways it's joining groups and forces to really protect our lands and prevent that from expanding, to prevent further loss and damage, which is necessary in these times of climate change.
Latinos are projected to make up 30% of the U.S. population by 2050, and over half reside in states with the highest levels of climate change threats. The Hispanic Access Foundation released its Cultural Erosion, the Climate Threat to Latino Heritage report at the recent COP28 conference in Dubai. This is Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy this evening, becoming overcast overnight, a low of 39. Tomorrow's weather, overcast with a high of 48. We could see some rain roll in on Saturday. Today in history, on this date in 1999, the euro debuted, uniting Europe with a common currency. The quote of the day is from former German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The euro is our common fate, and Europe is our common future. House Republicans threaten a shutdown over the border. Bomb threats force evacuations at multiple state capitals. And a federal judge rules 2021 Georgia voter registration challenges did not violate the law. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks with Catherine Carley.
If President Biden wants a supplemental spending bill focused on national security, it better begin by defending America's national security.
House Speaker Mike Johnson joined 60 fellow Republicans at a Texas border crossing Wednesday to demand strict immigration policies in exchange for aid to Ukraine. Illegal crossings topped 10,000 on several days last month. Republicans want more of a border wall and to make asylum harder to get. House leaders say they'll also move ahead with impeaching Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And some Republicans have taken an even harsher tone. Texas Representative Chip Roy says shut down the border or they shut down the government.
We're supposed to check an out-of-control executive branch, use the power of the purse to stop funding it. Because you know what? If you fund it, you own it.
Several state capitals reported bomb threats yesterday, causing temporary evacuations and disrupting court hearings. Police found no explosives, and officials quickly deemed the threats a centrally organized hoax. Former President Donald Trump has formally asked the U.S. Supreme Court to toss the Colorado Supreme Court ruling, removing him from the primary ballot there. He says it's up to Congress to decide whether he engaged in insurrection.
We will fight for America like no one has ever fought before. 2024 is our final battle.
Maine Secretary of State removed Trump from that state's ballot over his role in January 6th. The questions also reached the Oregon Supreme Court and is pending in 15 other states. A federal judge has ruled the right-wing group True the Vote didn't violate the Voting Rights Act when challenging hundreds of thousands of Georgia registrations in 2021. True the Vote founder Katherine Engelbrecht hailed the ruling as a win for faithful patriots.
We have got to get up out of our comfort zones and do more than just vote. We have got to demand a fair and honest process because it is slipping away from us in plain sight.
The group offered a $1 million bounty for reports of fraud and threatened to recruit Navy SEALs as enforcers. Election officials worry the ruling could end up encouraging voter intimidation. House Education Chair Virginia Fox says Harvard President Claudine Gay's resignation is the right move, but it won't stop her committee's investigation into campus anti-Semitism and diversity policies.
I think they have some other things coming their way to make them understand that they are getting hardworking taxpayer dollars and they have to be accountable.
State legislatures considered more than 500 anti-LGBTQ bills last year, nearly three times the number in 2022. Many would ban health care for transgender youth or change public school curriculum. 84 became law in 23 states. And anti-vaccine activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has collected enough signatures to appear on the 2024 presidential ballot in Utah. I'm Catherine Carley.
Legal service advocates are training people in Montana's indigenous communities how to provide crucial legal aid on the state's seven tribal reservations.
Mark Moran tells us about the Tribal Advocate Incubator Project.
A new program from the Montana Legal Services Association is boosting legal assistance to people living on the state's tribal land. And it's giving lay people the skills they need to help Montana's underserved indigenous population. Many of Montana's indigenous people lack legal services or the money they need to pay for them. The Incubator Project recruits and trains lay people from each of Montana's indigenous communities to help tribal members who need legal assistance. Valerie Falls Down is an advocate herself and the person who coordinates the 14-week training program. She says while the lay advocates are not lawyers, they are equipped to help address some of the unique legal challenges Montana's tribal members face.
The remote nature of Montana's 7 reservations and the lack of locally available educational programs for lay advocates contribute to the shortage of qualified lay advocates in Montana's tribal communities. So it has a huge impact with all of the community members who now have access to legal services.
7 students from each of Montana's tribal reservations recently took part in a mock trial in Billings to practice the skills they'll use when they represent tribal members in their communities. Most legal issues on the reservation wind up in tribal court, and to practice law in tribal court, MLSA's Catherine Seaton says lawyers have to be licensed to practice there. Since most are not, this program provides opportunities for local lay advocates.
By providing education and mentorship opportunities and case referrals to people from tribal communities who want to open up their own businesses and provide legal services to low and moderate income people who have legal issues in tribal courts.
This is Mark Moran.
In 2023, we lost several notable people in politics, including longtime California U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. I talked to OSU history professor Dr. Chris Nichols about her legacy and some other notable Americans we lost in the year.
Feinstein is fascinating. She was the author of the 1994 federal assault weapons ban. We were just talking about meaningful gun legislation or regulation and what's gone on in mass shootings. That comes out of the era of the 90s and trying to get rid of high-capacity weapons and assault weapons. And then that was let slide. And part of that is arguably where we land today with AR-15s proliferating, among other weapons. But she's a fascinating figure, California's first female senator, reelected a whole lot of times. The end of her career has been colored so much by the fact that her health seemed bad, and at times her mental acuities weren't great. There were some kind of viral clips of her seeming to nod off or not know exactly everything that was going on. She died a few months ago in September at 90. I wish on my best day in my 60s or 70s or 80s or something, I'll be as sharp as she was in her 80s into 90. I mean, she was awfully sharp, but of course she was diminished at the end of her career. Another thing that's interesting is she was in San Francisco politics, and what was so meaningful about the assault weapons ban and her work on gun control was because she was there when there were multiple assassinations. The mayor, Scone, and the city supervisor, Harvey Milk. And so that's how she became mayor. In fact, she became the first mayor ascending because of assassinations. And that led to her doing lots of stuff like being part of the Democratic National Convention and a whole host of other things and really rising in American politics and making herself known on the U.S. stage as a leading woman and advocate of gun reform. And that sort of fits a little bit with thinking about someone like Sandra Day O'Connor. I had the great privilege at the Oregon Historical Society of interviewing historian Evan Thomas in his book First, which I would highly recommend, is First on Sandra Day O'Connor. One of the things that sticks out in my mind of her as a pioneering first woman to serve on the Supreme Court is that she was the last member of the court, I believe this is right, who had been elected to office, that had really been involved and invested in politics and understood the messy nature of compromise that's required. And if we think about the Supreme Court ruling on Colorado's case moving forward of disqualifying Donald Trump, think about the U.S. Supreme Court seeming as partisan as it ever has, all these disclosures of ethics violations. Someone like Sandra Day O'Connor is worth, even if you didn't like her politics or where she landed on her rulings, her way of thinking about politics because she had been involved and invested in actually doing everyday politics is really important and significant. I think something that American politics and society has lost is not having more jurists at the highest levels, but probably throughout, who've done more in politics and better understand not being an extremist from a far part of the spectrum of party politics, but rather having been in the mix. It's notable that she was nominated by Ronald Reagan and succeeded by Samuel Alito. She was part of a lot of major rulings. She wrote in the Hamdi v. Rumsfeld case on Guantanamo. She wrote on Bush v. Gore. I think she was a lead in Planned Parenthood case that preserved legal access to abortion. Just a really fascinating and pioneering Supreme Court justice. You mentioned Rosalynn Carter.
Yeah, I've been thinking, okay, we're probably going to see the Jimmy Carter obituary any day now. And it was Rosalynn who passed. And I was, frankly, I was surprised because I guess there was so much focus about him being in hospice all this time that I didn't even realize that her health was declining as well. And yeah. I think those two will probably be remembered most for Habitat for Humanity. Yep. I would think that's their greatest legacy.
Yeah, I teach the Carter presidency and transition into the Reagan years all the time in class. And it's interesting. I think students were really interested in Jimmy Carter and were quite impressed with the ways that Carter's rhetoric in particular appealed to wider swaths of Americans and has been derided in saying malaise speech. But he was asking Americans to look at themselves and say, hey, what can you do to solve these big problems? How can you take everyday individual action and agency and things like energy and that sort of thing? And then that's instantiated into things after the presidency like Habitat for Humanity. How can you actually help build a house to help someone in your community or nearby? And then one of Rosalynn's, I think her signature issue was health, public health, mental health. And that was a lifelong kind of commitment. And certainly as a first lady, mental health awareness. And really, if you think about the transition from their era coming out of the White House in 1981 to the present 2023, looking to 2024, the ways in which we talk about mental health are just totally transformed. The parking garage I just left had all these numbers saying, if you are depressed, call this number. If you have any need, call this number. We just have regularized this in our lives so much more. We don't sweep it under the rug nearly as much. And having a first lady talk about those things honestly is the sort of thing that bully pulpit makes possible in broader discourse. You can never just attribute it to her that she was the one or someone else was, but that they lots of folks in public life talk about mental health issues is really important. And the same sort of thing with the kinds of claims that Carter was making. Look into yourself. What can you do for your community? And then he lived that every day, right? The first evangelical president out there trying to make the world better and bring the good news of the world, not just proselytizing, but living it and building homes and trying to create peace, being a special emissary for all kinds of things.
Yeah, I think he wasn't appreciated in his time, but he's grown to be more appreciated over time is the way it seems to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it seems that way to the younger generation. I'm just surprised how much my students like Jimmy Carter. I thought they would be bored by his addresses, to be honest with you. We'd have to unpack them slowly, but they were interested. They were positive.
That's good. That gives me some hope. Okay. Henry Kissinger, another big one that we lost in terms of impact in the Vietnam War, and he had a major impact on American foreign policy.
Absolutely, and world history, and one of the arguably, if not the most powerful Secretary of State since World War II, and then you could add him to the top five or so lists in U.S. history overall. People talk about it, his time in kind of diplomatic terms, sometimes a complicated legacy. Other folks are much more polemical and tough, and they say he was a war criminal. People abstract kinds of claims, say things like he was an articulator of amoral realism, a kind of view that putting the U.S.'s interests best and first always, including the potential, say, in Vietnam, an example of this, a tragic, sad one, is essentially selling out South Vietnamese who had collaborated with the U.S. and were working closely with the U.S. when the U.S. withdrew. Terrible things happened to lots of them. Sure, you had boat people coming to the U.S., et cetera, but many more died or were incarcerated because of the way that the U.S. pulled out. He didn't mind. That was not a problem for Henry Kissinger. So a really fascinating life, such a long life. Social media memes have been about who all has died in the time that people have been waiting for Henry Kissinger to pass away. The other things, probably everyone listening has some sense of this, but his engineering and work on the U.S. opening to China is one of those really fascinating and important elements. You have to remember that the U.S. wasn't officially engaging with China for the longest time. They only recognized Taiwan. So for the longest time, the U.S. throughout the early Cold War really wasn't doing diplomacy with China. Kissinger was one of the main figures pushing that forward, resetting U.S. relations with the Soviet Union, lots of Middle East diplomacy. They call it shuttle diplomacy, moving station to station, working around with different local figures and leaders to try to triangulate deals that would be useful, create peace, be good alliances for the U.S., secure access to fossil fuels, minimize conflict, secret negotiations. So it's just such a muddied, mixed legacy for sure. And yet, when you zoom out, absolutely significant in historical perspective. Henry Kissinger was one of the major political figures of the 20th century.
Dr. Nichols is a history professor at The Ohio State University. He is a former board member of the Oregon Historical Society and is hosting an event there called Historians and the News next Wednesday, January 10th. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 4th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Ezra, Mark Moran, Roz Brown, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for listening. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the